So there are still things like, you know, my first job, like so many Americans, my first job was at McDonald's. And I learned so much from working at McDonald's when I was 15 that we still apply to our business today. Yeah. And I think that's what so many people don't take the time to reflect on is every single step of your life, there are things that you learn and there are reasons that you are at the place you are now. And you should really understand all of those lessons that you've learned and how you're applying them to where you're at now.
You're listening to Hooked on Startups, where every week you'll hear from some of the most talented, inspiring, and successful entrepreneurs who share their real life stories, how they overcame challenges and failures, and how they mastered success. Get ready for some of the best business tips, tricks and tactics, and some frank, unscripted discussions. Here's your host, Matthew Sullivan.
Today on Hooked on Startups, I'm absolutely delighted to have Josh and Brent from Beekman 1802. Josh and Brent, welcome to Hooked on Startups.
Oh, happy to be here.
So let me tell you, I got a tiny bit about Beekman 1802 because there's so much to say. So I don't want to ruin it, but Beekman 1802 is a TV show. It's a best-selling cookbook. It's a website, a tourist destination, and it's all inspired by the Beekman 1802 farm in Sharon Springs that you bought, as you say in some of your stories, at the top of the market.
We're not going to give any real estate advice today.
is it buy high, sell low? Is that the? I think that's how we normally do it.
That's our plan. We'll let you know how it works. We were two New York City guys. I worked in advertising for many years in Manhattan, and Brent was a physician. And Martha Stewart chose him to start her health and wellness division. We were driving in upstate New York in 2006. We're going apple picking, like obnoxious Manhattanites. And we drove by this farm and we fell in love with it. And we bought it originally just as a weekend place. We thought it'd be fun, like two city people having a farm. And we took in a neighboring farmer who was losing his farm. Then he brought his goat, so we had like a little petting zoo. It was just supposed to be this fun little thing. And then in 2008, we both lost our jobs in the recession. And we had to find out how to make the farm pay for itself. So we Googled, what can you do with goat milk? And we started making goat milk soap. We worked with one of our neighbors, Soapmaker Deb, who introduced us to another neighbor, Blacksmith Michael and Weaver Karen and Potter Sonny. And we found all these artisans and craftspeople that were making amazing products, but they didn't know how to get them to market in a way that was either profitable or on a scale that was big enough to let them do what they love for a living.
So you've got Blacksmith Michael, Potter Sonny. There's also a soap.
Soapmaker Deb.
Soapmaker Deb, exactly. So what do they call you? So they call you the Lords of the Manor or
what they call us, Beekman Boys, because the name of the farm is Beekman Farm. And when we first moved there, all the locals, they're like, well, these two city guys, they're not going to make it. So we're not even going to bother learning their name. We're just going to call them the Beekman Boys.
And I think you may be actually forgetting something slightly, because when you said we got some goats and then we made goat soap, what's the bit in between? Because this is all about the, because you make it sound so easy. So we lost our jobs, bought a farm, and then became this iconic brand, which was really easy. And so it's, can we just explore, were there any challenges that you faced in between maybe?
Yeah, the bit in between was desperation.
Yes.
That's why we always say to anyone who asks us how we did it, we said you have to be desperate, because desperation is the best motivation. And unless you're really, really hungry for something, you're not going to have the drive and the motivation and the commitment and the sustainability that you need to make it a success, because nothing is an overnight success. And so really being hungry and making sure that you really do have that fire and the necessity to succeed, that's really what's going to make you succeed.
I completely agree with you, because there's this whole concept of people just doing stuff. They always seem to forget those sleepless nights and those moments where you stare yourself in the mirror going, what have you done? But you have to have a vision.
Last night.
I'm with you there. Don't worry. It's a daily event for me as well. But the other thing really is this vision, because you could quite easily have ditched the farm and just thought, you know, what have we done? We bought this, you know, we've lost our jobs. But there was something there clearly. And this is all about vision. This is all about, what was that that inspiring moment? And can you sort of quantify how you took that thing that you had where you're saying to each other, look, you know, I don't know what this is, but we've got something here.
Yes. Well, once we lost our jobs and we had to figure out a way to pay the mortgage on the farm, that was the desperation. We Googled and learned how to make the goat milk soap. And then we looked at our competitive set for goat milk soap. And we said, how can we break through in this market that's already very crowded, not only with other soap products, but even goat milk soap products? And so we said, where would this product live that it doesn't already live? And so we said, oh, you know what? The luxury department stores in New York City do not typically carry artisanal soaps. And so I reached out, I did a cold call to a department store in New York City on Fifth Avenue called Henry Bendel, one of the, you know, old grand dames of department stores in New York City. And they said, if you will come down here during holiday season and sell your product on the floor of our store, we will give you a shot. We'll give you a space for 8 weeks.
Yeah.
And so I would get up every morning, I would load up the truck, take all of the product to the train station. I'd have to get up at like 3 o'clock in the morning, take the train trip from the farm down into New York City, a 3-hour trip, get to the department store, stand on the floor of the department store all day selling the soaps. The department store would close. I would get back on the train, make the 3-hour trip back to the farm,
yeah,
and do the same thing every day for 8 weeks. I did that because we knew that that's what it would take to launch the brand. And by virtue of putting in that, well, first identifying where the product would be unique and different on its own, so in luxury department store, and then to putting that time commitment in to tell our product story, the reward of that was that one of the buyers from a large store chain in the US, Anthropologie, came by and saw me selling the soap and heard me tell my story. And then they became our first big client and purchased 25,000 bars of soap. And
that's a lot of goats.
Yeah. And again, that's what I'm getting back to is that desperation is that when you are desperate, you will say, you know what, I can put in a 20-hour day every day for the next 8 weeks because I have to.
You know, desperation doesn't mean like, oh, I'm going to, you know, go broke or I'm going to whatever, even though that was true in our case. But desperation is like, I cannot for one more day do this job that I'm doing. Yeah, go back to that office. Or I cannot for one more day suppress this dream I've had.
I think that's the key thing. You're right, because desperation sort of means that you had a choice, I guess, because you could have done 10 different things.
Yeah, we could have walked away from the farm. Yeah.
And really, it's about this journey. And also, it's about the story, because that becomes part of the story, which becomes part of the brand, which becomes part of the journey. So every one of those hours that you spend on the train is almost sort of embedded in the soaps and the products that you sell.
Yeah, and every one of, we call all of our customers neighbors. So every one of our Beekman neighbors, that they know our story and they know what it took for us to save that farm. And when they're using the products, they're thinking, you know what, someday I'm going to live my dream and I'm going to quit my job and I'm going to go do this other thing that I've always dreamed of. So every time they use our soap, it's a reminder to them that they can do that or eat our cheese or, you know, buy our jam or whatever. It's a reminder that, oh, these guys did it, what, you know, and wound up living their dream. So I can do it too.
And the big challenge that I know that you faced with Anthropologie was pricing, because you've got a big chain there. So you've got this tension between what you want as the lifestyle brand. Yeah. And I guess at that point, did you know it was a lifestyle brand or was it still evolving?
No, we were just trying to sell product. But what saved us, you know, Anthropologie is a very, you know, it's a luxury company, but we were making an artisanal product that didn't have a profit margin, didn't have a high profit margin. And either we didn't know enough at the time or there was just no way around it. We couldn't sell this product at wholesale. There was just, because it was a handmade good. And we were trying to figure out what it was about the making of the soap that was causing the wholesale cost to be so high. And it turned out that our goat, in making the soap, there's a very fine layer of ash that forms on the surface of it. And when you make natural soap, and you have to hand carve each that layer off if you want your soap to be clean and presentable. That is what was driving the cost up. And so we said the only way around that is to leave that ash on. So we created a little note that went in every bar of soap and said, you know, this bar of soap is pure and natural because it has a fine layer of ash on the top of it that washes away with your first use. So that was our lesson in, you know, turning a negative into a possible, which seemed like an insurmountable obstacle, make that a selling point.
And was that the point where, was it the Anthropology deal that made you think you've actually got something here? Or, because again, talking about stages of success, because when one starts out in business, you go, I'm going to be the global, you know, dominator of this market. And life never seems to sort of follow that path.
I think the one personality trait that Josh and I both share, which I think has made us successful.
We share something?
Yeah.
I think. Oh my God.
Is that we are very good about seeing possibility, and we never close the door on any opportunity. So, you know, when Anthropology came knocking, it was never, oh, well, we can't do that, or we're not big enough to do that. It's like, oh, here's the opportunity. How can we make it work?
It might not work the way that Anthropology wanted it to, or the way that we originally envisioned it to, but how can we make this particular opportunity bring it to completion?
And I think that's a very important point, because I was talking to someone, again, a few weeks back, who set out to cycle around the US and unfortunately damaged his foot on day two. he's set to walk around the US.
Oh, God.
And ended up cycling. But this whole concept that, as you just said, it may not be what you imagined it would be, but it's right. You can't close those doors. So, and again, how different was this way of life to compare to Madison Avenue or what you were used to in New York?
Well, I think at the time when we started the company in 2009, in terms of like seeing the opportunities in front of you, you know, this was right as social media was taking off. I think we were probably one of the very first farms in the world that had a Facebook page, because Facebook at that time was just where you were, you know, having high school reunions, you know, that type of thing. And so we created, you know, the Facebook page for the farm, and always said from the beginning, the farm could be bigger than its fences. And in fact, in order to cover our mortgage, the farm would have to be bigger than its fences. And that's kind of how the idea for lack of a better word, the lifestyle brand began. Was we wanted our farm to be bigger than its fences. And again, at that point in time, people thought we were crazy that we were investing time and energy in creating content for Facebook from our farm, because that was not how Facebook was being used. But it, you know, again, I think it's seeing opportunities or doors that have opened, and maybe it's not, as you just said, the door that you thought was going to open, but nonetheless, it is the door that is open. How do you figure out where that door is going to lead you? And I think that's, you know, that's what has been and always will be our success.
Actually, I just thought of a really, it's either a very inspiring or very depressing truth about our lives. There we have a bottle of champagne in our basement that we brought when we moved to New York. And we've always said, yeah, just implicitly, like, we're going to open it when we succeed. Like when something really big happens, we're going to open it and celebrate. It's still sitting there. And when you talk about stages of success, there is no concrete measure of success. Every stage you get is just the platform for the next climb. And that bottle of champagne, we should probably open it at some point.
But the question there, I mean, but this is all about learning, I think, really, isn't it? Because, I mean, you're both, you know, highly qualified people in different fields. But did you find that what you were doing with Beekman 1802 almost set you back right to the very beginning in terms of your learning, as it were, for this, you know, in terms of community building and social media? And that's why the champagne hasn't been opened, because almost every time you do something new, is it that you realize how little you know? Because that's a trait that I find with really successful people, is that they spot that you know what I mean? That the more you find out.
Absolutely. We are never bashful about exploring the depths of our ignorance. You know, we understand that there's so much that we don't know. And, you know, I particularly often get asked, because my career trajectory has been, you know, physician, executive Martha Stewart, goat farmer, you know, it's a very varied kind of career trajectory. And people will always say, oh, well, don't you regret all of that time you spent in medical school or the time you spent practicing or you know, when I say no, because if a really wise person learns something every step of the way. So there are still things like, you know, my first job, like so many Americans, my first job was at McDonald's. And I learned so much from working at McDonald's when I was 15 that we still apply to our business today. Yeah. And I think that's what so many people don't take the time to reflect on is every single step of your life, there are things that you learn and there are reasons that you are at the place you are now. And you should really understand all of those lessons that you've learned and how you're applying them to where you're at now.
And again, did it take this whole concept about if you want to be different, then you've got to, or if you want to do something different, then you've got to be different. So in other words, I just want to explore those early days when you're thinking, well, we don't quite know what this is, but it's, and how did you find that determination? I know you talk about desperation, but I don't think that's exactly it. I think there's some desire that to do something better and bigger.
Well, yes, it was, I think when we started working with our neighbors and different artisans and craftspeople, we saw the reaction of the people buying the products. We saw there was something that really resonated with them buying a product that had a story that was true, that wasn't a marketing story, and it was a story they could follow on social media. So it was they're attaching meaning to a product that we saw resonate with the consumers. That was exciting to us. And so the consumers started getting involved in our life and they started, you know, sharing their lives with us. And so the company wasn't ours from day one. It was this community of neighbors. They celebrate our success every step of the way. Every time we land a big account, we go into Target or we, you know, do television retail or something. They feel as if it's their success too.
And it is.
And it is because it's this, they were there from the beginning or they joined in at some point, but they're so intimately involved. So I think if it was a business where we were just looking at numbers on paper and saying, if we make this much and we sell it for this much, we're going to make this much, neither one of us would be interested. It was that building of a community, both of customers, artisans, and, you know, in our team, our employees, that really keeps us going.
Yeah. And I think that did come out of, you know, the fact that our company started and kind of this journey with Beekman 1802 started out of the recession. And when we were living and working in New York City, as you know, a lot of people who are married to their careers, so to speak, you do lack any sense of community. You don't know your neighbor. You know, we lived in the same apartment for 12 years in Manhattan, and we knew two of our neighbors in a 52 apartment building, you know, complex. Yeah. And, you know, I think once we moved to the small rural area, we had a complete change of philosophy about interconnectedness, about what it means to have and build a community, what it means to support other people outside of just trying to support yourself and pay your rent. And I think that more than anything else, more than the quality of the product, more than the type of product that we create, that sense that community is important and that what you're creating and what you're buying and what you're ultimately building is about building a community. And that's why, you know, Josh, as we call all of our customers neighbors, and, you know, now we sell our product all over the world and every single customer considers themselves a neighbor, whether they have the opportunity to come and actually be here in Sharon Springs or not. They have their own side conversations on social media. They all call themselves neighbors. You know, they love going into the airport and spotting someone carrying a Beekman bag and say, I'm a neighbor too. Like, it really is
a community. I mean,
people are hungry for that.
Yeah, I mean, I worry about letting them down. I don't, I don't worry about not making a sale. I worry about letting the community down. Like it's just more than a transactional.
And do you think that truth, that vulnerability, that transparency is the core to your brand? And is that what separates it from something that's been manufactured
That's us.
That's a very good point, because, and I think this also ties back to the rise of social media and where we started, because we had always been very confessional on social media. And then because the Fabulous Speakman Boys TV show kind of documented that period in our life where we were at our lowest and trying to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps, so to speak, our story has always been very transparent. And so as social media kind of took off and this kind of living your life in front of everybody else just became the mainstream, whether you have a business or not, we were just already there. And so people have always looked to us for the honesty and the authenticity of it, because they have seen it. It's not something that, oh, all of a sudden, here's this story that some marketing person made up. They have literally been with us when we had not even made the first bar of soap. Like, we were not even at that point yet.
And do you think that's a generational thing? So do you think it's the millennials, the Gen Z, are more able to spot this sort of social media fabrication?
Yeah. Oh, they're born with it.
They have a very fine-tuned social media BS meter.
Yeah,
and you can really see it, and you can tell instantaneously when there's a brand or a company who some outsourced person is managing their social media, because there's no soul to it at all. It's like, oh, here's a product, or here's a pretty nicely crafted image, but you can tell if that's all it is.
Yeah,
and I think that's where a lot of companies go wrong, is that they don't realize that you can no longer be superficial and be success. The consumer has to see the layers and feel the layers that go all the way through.
Because historically, and again, you'll know this from your advertising background, that the consumer was fed information. This is the brand. These are the beliefs. This is what you will associate with this brand. Mm-hmm. And social media is giving us that window, that looking glass, as it were, into the reality.
Yeah, I think people of our generation or older, when a product made a claim, we desperately wanted it to be true. You know, if a product made a claim that, it's going to take 10 years off your life or 10 years off your face, you're like, please let that be true. And so we buy into it.
You had no way to disprove it.
You didn't know. And you wanted it to be true. I believe that millennials and Gen Z, I believe they see that their finite resources and the finite resources of the world right now. And they almost want to prove it false because it's too good to be true. So we want to believe it. They want to prove it false. So,
and if you think about it, just 15 years ago, if a company made a claim about a product, or they said, oh, this is going to change your life, you had to believe it because that's the only information you had. But exactly. Now you can look up on the internet, see every review of a product. You can investigate further and find out, is this a multinational company that's making this thing that they're trying to sell me? So there's just... The internet has made the transparency so
transparent.
Easy. Right. You can't hide from
even transparency is transparent.
You can't. Yes.
No, you're right. I mean, there's real transparency and then there's manufactured transparency. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. But again, it's the challenge for you then just to say, well, we've actually got something fantastic here. Is there a scale? Is there something now that you want to, you've got a, the products that you have, is your objective to say, well, how do we take the brand values that we have, which is honesty, transparency, vulnerability, confessional, as it were, where you know how this is being made. Here are the makers. I know that your range has expanded massively over the last few years. Do you want to try, are you going to keep it small and boutique or?
No, this is what's interesting. So when we started getting larger opportunities,
and again, that's the key word. And going back to the first of the conversation, you see an opportunity in front of you.
Yeah.
And you might say, oh, no, we're not a brand that can handle Target or we should handle Target. Yeah. But we said, how can we make that opportunity?
How can we make this work? Because there was no way that we were going to get our, you know, Anne-Marie, who makes jams on her stovetop, to be able to make it a scale or a price point that we're going to sell to Target. So, but these opportunities came calling, these larger opportunities. So we really went right to our neighbors on social media, our customers, and we explained, we said, guys, you know, we cannot scale this company past a certain point. There have been better companies than us that have tried to build large global national companies based on artisanal crafts, and it can't be done. However, if we do make products overseas, some products overseas, they will be at a price point that more people can afford, and it will allow us to continue to offer artisanal and handmade goods at, that have a lower price margin. So we have a higher margin over here, a lower margin with our artisans. It all helps each other. We literally explained that to our customers.
Yes.
And they loved it.
They bought it.
So then they didn't have to feel guilty because they could only afford the chair at Target. They couldn't afford the chair made by our woodworker, Carl. They didn't have to feel it because that chair at Target was supporting Carl.
Yeah.
And regardless of where, what income strata they were and which type of product they were buying, they all felt and still feel that they're part of the community.
Yeah, just being that transparent, saying, guys, this is the opportunity. This is how it's going to help you. This is how it's going to help the artisans. This is how it's going to help us and our employees, whom they also love, grow.
Which is a tremendous responsibility on you, because you've created this belief. You have your flock, as it were. So, yeah, you've got the Targets, the Walmarts, the big, you know, the big...
Well, not Walmart.
Not Walmart.
Okay. We draw the line somewhere, sorry. I'll plead my, you know, English card here, not fully... but that's the thing. So how do you navigate that path with all these people whispering into your ear, you know, sell, reduce the quality?
Yeah. I think for us, you know, it really, we never create anything that we ourselves would not have in our house or use on our skin or put into our bodies. And I think at least at this stage of our company, we are the filter, because if for a lifestyle company, we always, you know, use that in air quotes because we hate that kind of term, lifestyle company, even though that's the standard term. We are the lifestyle. It's not manufactured. We are the ones doing the chores on the farm. We're in the garden. We're the ones cooking the food. So we are living it, and we're creating products that we're using. That's
actually, yeah, one of the things that has made it easy is television retail. So we had an opportunity 2 years ago to go on a shopping channel. And we had never thought about it, but we thought, oh, we'll give it it could be fun. We'll give it a try. And having to stand there for hours at a time and talk about your product and every single piece about it, because you've literally got hours to talk about your product. You couldn't do that if it wasn't something that you believed in. You would just be standing there lying for 2 hours. I don't think anybody is capable of that. So in an odd way, that television retail has become a weird door-to-door sales where you are face-to-face live with a consumer. And that's been like, that's one of the reasons we can never cut corners, because we would have to stand up there and admit that we were cutting corners.
Yes. You know? Yeah. And again, that's the, that all comes back to what I've noticed with all the people that I've spoken to is once you get that initial success, and it no longer becomes about the dollars and about the, and it sounds like it never was in your case, but you get the fact that if we make enough of this stuff and sell enough of it, we'll all be rich enough for three generations. Mm-hmm. Did you then find that it becomes about responsibility or about a bigger purpose?
Yeah, we've set our own bar that we have to live up to. And, you know, we're not saving the world. I think it's, for us, it's more of, is there a different way of doing business? Is there a way? We've seen a lot of artisans and craftspeople and makers try to build business and not be able to scale and ultimately fail. We've seen a lot of large corporations try to help artisans and craftspeople and do it differently and fail at that. For us, it's just sort of an interest. Can we create a responsible company that's not all charity and it's not all profits? What is the in-between that everyone can feel good about?
And I think for us, as you pointed out, it has never been about becoming a billionaire or having a yacht. It's about the connections that we make with people, because that to us is true wealth, are the happiness and the connections that you're making to people. Because even at this point, even though we're still a growing company, we have ourselves enough. Like we're not starving. You know, we're covering the mortgage on the farm.
A yacht would be nice.
But it really is about how can we make other people happy and content and make those connections. That's the rewarding thing.
That's
going
to say, I love Christmas morning. We realized a couple of years ago, we woke up Christmas morning and rather than run to our own tree and open our presents for each other, we woke up, we got our laptops out. I'm dead, as we do every morning. And we just started going down Facebook, and everybody that was posting, I get chills just thinking about posting like the Beekman things that were under their tree.
Oh, wow.
What a amazing, that's the best feeling in the world, is that you were someone's Santa Claus, you know? So that's our wealth. That's what makes us happy.
And you describe it perfectly, because I watched one of the videos where it was 10 things that your goats have taught you. But it's just that journey, it's just that unpeeling of all the layers that you kind of accumulated through the normal course. And it's just the ability to see that there is another way, and there is a completely different perspective out there that, is...
I think that's what you said, that it's the layers. The layers are things that you cannot manufacture. No matter how much some big corporation wants to create a brand, you cannot create those layers and that history in the way that we have. And that's why we're seeing, the makers movement and, the artisanal and the craftsmanship and buying quality over quantity. The reason that is resonating so much these days is because you cannot manufacture that anymore. You have to have all of those layers, and the consumer has to see those layers, and they have to be a part of those layers being laid down. It's just literally the new reality in business.
But the other challenge is how do you bring that message to people that can't afford high quality?
And you know what, we engage our neighbors who can afford the higher quality to feel good. That goes back to my example about when we started making some items overseas for certain retailers. The people that were paying top dollar for the handmade artisanal crafts thing, they could have easily said, oh my God, you're denigrating the brand. You're watering it down. You're diluting it. This is horrible. I don't want to buy your high-end stuff anymore. But what we said to them was, congratulations. We're glad that you could support small farms and small artisans, small this. Not everybody can. And wouldn't you like them to be a Beekman neighbor as well? If somebody can't afford a $12 jar of jam, they want something Beekman, and they want to be part of the neighborhood. You can feel good about that. That's not denigrating the brand. That's expanding the neighborhood.
And I also think that we are always really focused on quality, no matter what price point we're at. So even like when we designed the collection for Target, obviously Target is a mass retailer that's somewhat focused on value. And, of course they're going to come back and say, oh, we want you to do this sofa and sell it for 99 cent. Right. And we're like, no, we're going to design something. It's going to be of great quality. It's going to be slightly more expensive than what you currently sell. But it's the quality that is the most important to us, not the profit margin. And I think no matter what strata we are creating something for, whether it's something really specific and niche, like one of our artists is making, that's going to carry a high price point, or whether it's something in mass, it's the focus on the quality and not the profit margin for us that's the most important.
And I completely believe it, sort of buy that, because I think it is just the fact that you've created this. It's more than a brand. It's almost a movement. Mm-hmm. And that movement has to be accessible. So I think it's fantastic that you've made that decision, because it would be so simple to keep this as a high value, expensive brand where it's only available in certain stores where you have to, mm-hmm. polish your shoes before you're allowed in.
Right. And I think for us, because we do have that personal philosophy of we have enough and don't need to have it all, I think that's what makes us able to operate a business with that focus on quality, because so often, you know, particularly if you're bringing in outside investors or you're going public, it is about the profit margin, and the profit margin becomes the thing that you have to work toward. But because our personal philosophy is not about accumulating wealth, it's about making people happy.
Yeah.
I think we couldn't have our company and focus on those things unless we had that underlying DNA that says we don't need to have it all.
And I think, you know, maybe it's because we came from the city and then we moved to a rural town of 547 people that's economically challenged. In the city, we knew that our friends and colleagues, they could get a $8,000 chair or $800 chair that was handmade. They could afford that, and that made them feel really, really good. When we lived in the country, they can't afford an $800 chair, but they couldn't get something that they could afford that was of a decent quality or a decent design. Yeah. So if we can offer them that, and we can offer the person in the city the $800 handmade chair, usually by the guy in the country, we've actually made them both happy and given them both what they want in a very honest way.
And we're often asked, you know, well, what other type of company is like your company, or what do you model your company after? And we have always said, even from the very first days of our company, that we model our company after Disney.
Yes.
And the reason we do that is because Disney has just been, and even going all the way back to Walt Disney and his original vision, it was something for everybody. It was an experience and not just a transaction of a product. Even though that's part of the story, it's how can I entertain? How can I, when people come to my resort, it's the happiest place on earth. How do you create those feelings? That's really what we try to do with Beekman 1802 is think how are, and we actually do this when we're coming up with product ideas. We're like, how is this product going to create a memory for people? And we actually call it the neighbor memory opportunity. So every time we're having NMOs, and that's really what every single product, every piece of content we create has to,
every event
has to create a memory for the customer.
Because it's, you're talking about not value for money, it's value for memory.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
Which is, and again, you're right. Because with the thing with Disney, I mean, where I live, it's very close, and it's just that quality, you know, that every time you go to Disney, you'll just be astounded by how clean everything, how everything works. Just the attention to detail. Mm-hmm. You know that when the lights go down, there's an army of people polishing, fixing, painting, just making sure that the next day's production is
exactly the same. Yeah.
Just as good as
exactly.
And that's real dedication, and that's
and egalitarian. I mean, they try to make it available to everyone. You know, you can get a St. Regis suite at Disney, you know, for your family at, you know, $28,000, or you can get a campsite for $40. But it's egalitarian. Everybody has a chance to have the experience,
and they all have the same experience. They all come away with that joyous grin.
Yeah, and yes. The same quality of experience.
Yeah, but it goes back to, again, Disney and what his DNA was. And he wanted to make people happy. Yes. So what, he wasn't in it just to make a lot of money. The central focus of everything was, how am I going to make people happy? Just like for us, is how are we going to make quality product for people?
It's the delivery of joys. It's the ability to make someone smile or feel loved or feel connected, which is the astonishing thing that you've created.
Yeah. And you can't do that if the money is your only motivation.
I think, you know, being in advertising for so many years, it was, you know, I think advertisers are the only people hated worse than lawyers. You know, I mean, they think, but I always thought of selling something as a wonderful thing. Like, if you have the opportunity to get somebody something that they want, I mean, that's like the best outcome for both of you.
It is. And just imagine the moment of joy as they open the packet with the artisanal soap and just that flush of excitement that whole story unfolds the moment that they and it is truly, you know, wonderful what you've created. So it's and it must be, there must be moments where you sit back and you look at that bottle of champagne and say, yeah, you know, we're getting there.
Actually, had forgotten about this.
I'm sorry to bring it up again. You know,
I know. We have to do something really worthwhile now.
But all your champagne, I have other questions for you now.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Oh.
My fabulously slightly borrowed questions, which is my rapid fire questionnaire round that I've borrowed temporarily from James Lipton. So thanks, okay. James. Please, you know, don't sue me. So my first question is, what is your favorite word?
Joy.
Yes.
Yes is your favorite word? Mm-hmm. Oh, I thought
not yes, joy, but
yeah. I like to say yes to people, and I like for people to say yes to me.
And your least favorite word?
Anxiety.
And when used in solitaire, no. You know, I never like to hear the word no with no explanation. I like to be convinced of why no is the answer.
No, as in no, I can't be bothered to come up with a reason.
Right.
Yeah. And what are you most excited about right now?
I'm always excited. This sounds weird, but I'm always excited about the next meeting.
Yeah.
Whatever, because that's the next chance for something to happen. Yeah. I cannot stand when things don't happen. Like, I have to have something in my hand that's changed every day.
Yeah, I agree. Again, it goes back to the opportunity. Like, if you have a new meeting with a new person you've never sat down with, you have no idea what opportunities there are going to be.
Exactly. And what turns you off right now?
Politics.
Yeah. This weird untelling of truth. You know, that not telling the truth is okay.
You mean the new truth?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Alternative facts.
It is. Yeah. You know, I'm, you're not alone. I can tell that.
Yeah.
Other people have mentioned this.
Yeah.
So what sound or noise do you love?
Oh, that this is easy. Our dog, when you scratch just in the right place, she has this amazing groan. She's in ecstasy.
That's so funny, because I was going to say our dog too, but I love in the morning hearing her nails on the floor, like when she's coming in to
the clip, like the clippity clop of the
yeah. I love to hear that coming down the hallway.
And what sound or noise do you hate?
The iPhone buzzing.
Yeah.
The notification. Yeah, to app. I agree. Notification. Instant panic. Even if it's good, it could be anything, but I always think it's the worst.
It'd be interesting to explore the sort of physiological connection between the sound of a bong and someone's heart rate. You know, in other words, Apple for causing, you know, significant anxiety. So what is your, leading on nicely, what is your favorite curse word?
Can we say it? I can say anything?
You can say anything you like.
Oh, I love fuck. I just use that all the time. It's fucking great. I mean, I have to be careful with. I think our colleagues know that I say it all the time.
But. Yeah, I don't really curse. I grew up in the South and evangelical, and so I use my cursing very, very selectively. But Josh knows if a curse word ever comes out, then it's that means I'm.
He means business.
Yeah.
Despite Josh's attempts to dilute the power of the expletive.
Yeah, it doesn't work.
You maintain ownership.
Frequency does not mitigate. Yeah.
Yeah. There's fuck and then there's fuck.
Yeah. That's right.
My next question is, what profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
I say whatever comes my way, you know. Yeah. I'm interested in everything, and you know, whatever is there, I would love to do it and learn about it. I could be just as happy selling popcorn in a movie theater and figuring out how to do that better as I could, you know, milking the goat. So
I'd like to be a priest, actually.
Have a flock.
I like community problem solving. Like old school vicar type thing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Fantastic. And what profession would you not like to attempt?
Anything financial.
Mm-hmm.
Like I just feel there's it's so far removed from humanity at this point.
And I would
say it's not like old school lending or investing or things had outcomes that matter to people. I feel now it's just investing for numbers on paper for people who just get more and more numbers.
And I would say I could find happiness in almost any type of job, you know, manual job, mental job. I think the only thing I wouldn't like is a job that somehow belittles or disparages another person. Mm-hmm. You know, like I couldn't do debt collector. Like that's not something I would like to do. Anything, or even bounty hunter, I think it would be hard for me to do. Anything that puts somebody down or in a bad position.
And anything, I guess, where you say, you know, I hate my job, but just think of the money.
Right, yeah. Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
So my final question then is, if heaven exists, what would you like to hear God say when you arrive at the pearly gates?
Hi, neighbor.
That would be great. Yes, hi, neighbor.
That's fantastic. That's brilliant. Well, guys, Josh, Brent, I can't thank you enough. It's been such a pleasure having you on. My final question is, how do people get hold of you? How do they find out more about these amazing products you're creating? How do they read and, you know, listen to your story and...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Beekman1802.com is our website, and you can get to our shopping from there.
And on social media, no matter what the platform, we're at Beekman1802Boys.
That's fantastic. Well, good, guys. Thank you so much. And as I said, it's been a real pleasure. And, you know, thanks again for being a guest on Hooked on Startups.
Thank you.